Hey everyone, welcome back to The Growth Signal, where we are rethinking our customer relationships, how we build them, how we keep them, and how we lead as customer expectations rapidly evolve. And I am so excited we have a great guest today. But first, I'm Alyssa Nolte.
And I'm Eli Weiss.
And we are going to get right into it. Eli, what is your hot take?
Hot take is, I think like retention is not a life cycle flow. Like, it's not a banner that says only three left. It's not a flashing bunch of lights. Retention is knowing who your customer is and what they expect and making sure they don't regret trusting you. I think like not everything is solved with a Klaviyo flow. And sometimes you got to pick up the damn phone and call your customers. I think if your idea is like personalization is like first name and an email flow, you're probably just not doing anything meaningful and building like a mildly sophisticated robocall operation. So I think that retention is just a lot less sophisticated than people think.
So I want to dive into a lot of the things that you just said, because like that is a hot take, right? Because
asked,
a lot of people,
spicy.
I love it. I love it. Sometimes I get like, when I say hot take, they're like, well, AI won't replace it. And I'm like, well, I mean, that's hot. So when we're looking at, you know, for example, your background, your job is VP of retention, right? So like, we're literally talking about your entire career kind of being not what people really thought it was. Because when I think retention, I'm sitting here thinking like, okay, there's a metric involved, there's some kind of health score, there's a contract renewal date. And my job is to make sure that I can get someone to say yes a second, third, or fourth time, instead of just the first time. But full transparency, I tend to live on the sales side. So for me, it's like it goes into a black box once it leaves my CRM.
Yeah, I want to derail the conversation for a second.
I love it.
All 2 seconds. My career has been funky because imposter syndrome played like such a big role in the way I operated for years. I played in the customer service, customer experience space. Like I worked at brands like Olipop and Jones Road Beauty and always had CX in my title. And then one day I put retention in there. And the biggest imposter syndrome things that I still deal with today is for years, I realized that the people that were front runners in retention were much better at spreadsheets than I am and can mess up a pivot table better than I can and are better than me at data. And for years I was like, I'm not that great at retention because I don't get the whole data side of the business. And 2024-5 was interesting slash is interesting because we got to a place where suddenly you being very good at Excel means jack shit to nobody because anyone can do that with ChatGPT. Yep. And now we're in a space where it's like you have to deeply understand what makes a customer choose you and how to get them to continue choosing you. And that part of retention is not generally taught in an MBA program. And it's not generally pulled out of an Excel spreadsheet. Those are the softer parts of retention. And I spent years kind of like feeling this and feeling like an imposter because I couldn't pull apart a pivot table and tell you the 37 different data points that I needed, but I can inherently gut check after talking to 30 customers what is broken and prove that out and help people stay. What that looked like at Jones is like, you know, I wasn't the most data savvy person. And partially why I felt like at some points I failed. Like I wasn't driving the business in the right way from a data-centric perspective, but I was able to kind of really deeply understand very quickly why people were coming for one product and then not coming and saying like, let me try the next product. Like why couldn't we get people past the hero product? And it's something that a spreadsheet might not tell you. You have to deeply understand customer behavior. What did we promise? How do we meet or beat or not even get near the expectation? And how do we drive like a really holistic business understanding to customers of like, what's our goal and not just buy this shit today because it'll help you with X and Y? That's like, to me, the difference between like the direct response growth marketing is most of them are very good at getting a sale. And what happens after that is like getting the sale doesn't mean getting the customer. And 6 months later, you're like, wait, but I spent $50. I got somebody for $60. I'm not even break even after my costs. Why don't they come back? And it's because you growth hacked your way into order number one. And that's kind of like me jumping into Yetpo was trying, how do we deeply understand what we've done wrong in the past from a deep perspective? Like what did we promise? How did we deliver slash not deliver? And how is that hurting us from going from a reviews platform to a loyalty program platform to a kind of like email, SMS? Like, how does that hurt us from continuing to conquer more of the market? But that's like my kind of like lens on retention that I think most people just flat out ignore.
Yeah. Every once in a while in these episodes, I'll get like a total mic drop moment that I just have to write down. And I'm going to say it back to you because I want to emphasize it for the listeners, but also it's like a moment where, yes, you're right. Getting the sale does not equal getting the customer. And I think too many of us think of any signed contract means they're our customer now. And that's not necessarily the case. There's a real like human side to the way people adopt and adapt and engage with their products. And as someone who works in B2B, sometimes it's too hard to remember that there's actual people who are making buying decisions and not necessarily just the company that I'm selling to, the amorphous entity that has purchased my software.
And B2B is even more interesting because you get to a space where selling is not enough. Like, you still need to execute the implementation and you still need to hand it over to a CS team. And the CS team still needs to be empowered by hoping you sold the right thing so they can properly support. And you get to like, okay, now we're heading on a renewal. If you sold properly and you supported properly and the implementation went smoothly, renewal is easy peasy. If you completely sold the wrong thing, it's super hard. Now, how does that play out on the brand side? Like, as somebody that spent the bulk of my career on the brand side, then switched to SaaS, brand is interesting because you see that so much faster, right? So like if I sell the perfect kind of like expectation, I nail it, I can see a repurchase in 21 days or 30 days. Whereas SaaS, it's like it can be 9, 10, 12 months, 24 months, 36 months.
So I work with clients who have a 3-year renewal contract and it's like, right. That's an entirely different set of human beings and situations after 3 years.
They could have been gone, right? Yeah. The person that bought it might be gone. And now you're like, okay, how do I reestablish a relationship with somebody that might be frustrated that the person before them purchased something they felt isn't necessary?
Right, right. And how do you continuously re-onboard your customers without making them feel like you're just throwing like busy work at them, right? There's a real balance between onboarding, reboarding, and then every time you add something new or something changes in their environment, how do you know when to do that without turning your customer off to your entire mission?
Why do some, like what, maybe I'm out of place spinning the interview around here and asking you questions, but—
Hell yeah, I love it.
But I'm curious, like, why do you feel some B2B companies are so much better than others at like setting that proper expectation and continuing to nail while others are just all over the place? Like, they sell and then you're like, wait, I have no idea what I got. The implementation is garbage. Like, where do people fail miserably there?
I'm a big believer in it's the freedom that you give to your team to make the decisions that reflect the situation that they're in, right? So I've consulted with big enterprise companies where we went back and forth for six emails and a meeting to discuss which line should be bolded in an internal email.
Yes.
And like, that is not a good use of anyone's time. And that's an extreme example, but that was like the culture where everything required permission and everything had, you weren't allowed to talk to customers that weren't specifically yours. And if you weren't the account manager assigned to that account, you better not even speak to that customer. And so they created this rigidity that didn't allow for people to react like human beings to other human beings. And I think that that's the piece that's missing. The companies that do it well allow for you to be truly customer-centric within the bounds that they've created. But your decision-making as an employee, no matter who you are, if you're touching the customer, interfacing with the customer, you have the freedom to make the choices that work for the customer. And I think that's my hypothesis of what makes a great performing team and what misses the mark.
And it's funny because I think people view B2B and B2C as so dramatically different, but it's the way I'd see it, it's kind of one and the same. Like on a B2C side, the brands that I see fail and spending my career predominantly on customer experience, but then kind of wishy-washy in the retention space, I've seen that brands that fail, it's because they overthink and over-engineer what the
yes.
customer experience should look like. Like, instead of just being super straightforward and upfront, like, hey, we sold you something that doesn't exist and we're actually in the midst of production and it can take 3 weeks and it might even take 4. Instead of saying that, they'll be like, the warehouse is packing, but there's a fire, and they'll just BS their way through it, and customers see through that. So I think it's like, it's not that far apart. They're all people to people versus like B2C, B2B.
I do think that there's lessons to be learned from both sides, right? You mentioned like with B2B, you have this implementation experience, right? And so even if you sold the wrong thing, if the implementation goes bad, well, then like it doesn't matter. You're going to have a hard time. If you don't manage the change management aspects, if you have people inside who didn't want this solution, or you know they prefer Microsoft Teams, but now they're getting Zoom, right? Those different experiences. There's a lot more factors that are hidden, and you don't really get an opportunity to know what those are. You made a comment about like over-engineered. I think that's 100% one of the like gut reactions that all of these B2B leaders make is, we'll make a process and everyone will follow the process and we'll know if something's wrong because it's not in the process. But the reality is, and someone on the show, I'm gonna have to go back and put it in the show notes, said, the more time you spend on your customer journey map, the wronger it probably is. And this idea that just because it's your customer journey map doesn't mean it's your customer's journey. And I was like, oh, that was another one of those like mic drop moments of, yeah, you're right. Just because that's the journey I want them to take does not mean that's the journey they are taking.
That's so good. Wow, that's a good one. I think it's like on the brand side, we create these like massive maps on the wall of customer journeys and kind of like draw a whole bunch of dotted lines. And then the reality is, like we saw this at Jones, like we tried so hard to get people from category one to category two. For example, like if everyone was buying a Miracle Balm, we tried so hard to get them into a moisturizer. And turns out customers would rather buy three different Miracle Balms and three different variations or three different shades versus try something that you're pushing so hard. So you're losing money by trying so hard and wasting all that real estate by trying so hard to be aggressive versus just let them go where they're already going and maybe kind of like try to push already existing behavior, maybe speeding it up a little bit versus trying to create this like net new behavior that I think marketers inherently have large egos and think that they can, you know, they lack humility to think that they, especially on the growth side, I think they lack humility to think that people sometimes can have a mind of their own. And not everything is propaganda that you can just kind of push through. I think even brands like Apple, right, like got to a point where it's like maybe not everyone wants huge goggles on their eyes and wants to live in a VR, AR reality today. Yeah. And I think it's a humbling moment for super large brands, but we've seen so many in the hardware space create these like net new experiences that the market's just not there yet. Even electric cars, like we've seen that over there. There have been electric car companies 15 years plus ago. And it's only fairly recent that the market's there. And I think as much as we think we can impact very quickly, humans don't always behave that way.
No, they certainly do not. I feel like I need to have like a banner in front of my desk that says you are not your customer, because it's really easy, right? So I don't work in marketing. I have a product. I'm working as a founder. And for me, of course, everything makes sense. And of course, it makes sense to go from A to B and then from B to C, because that makes sense to me, because I have the perspective of my own experiences and what I'm building. But just because I understand it doesn't mean that that's the way it's actually going to work. So being able to step out of your own echo chamber and actually, I don't know, have a revolutionary idea of actually talking to your customers, discussing. I know it shouldn't be revolutionary, but somehow every time I say, that's my hot take, maybe you should actually talk to your customers.
Yeah.
So let's pivot into the proactive then. If someone is hearing this and they say, oh, you know what, we have missed the mark on this, or we're trying to really drive forward a better experience. We want to be one of those companies that gets talked about as doing it well, not one of the ones we make fun of on this podcast. What should they do first? What is the number one thing they should start doing in order to start moving this direction?
I'd say the biggest, and kind of similar to what you mentioned before, some of the biggest failures happen when brands think that it needs to be a full-blown process that takes 12 months, and they kind of map out this ideal group of people they need to talk to, and they kind of start building out a roadmap, and it's a six-month process versus just send the email. Just like send the email to 60 customers. You can hypothesize, like for us, it was like people that purchased once in the last 120 days, but not, you know, what, like figure out what that timeline is. They purchased once, didn't purchase again. So we knew that they are willing to give us a shot once. We're trying to understand why they don't come back again. Send them an email. Hey, my name is Eli. I recently joined the team and I'm trying to better understand their customers. Would you be down to talk for 15 or 20 minutes? It would be super helpful for me to collect feedback and better understand how we can make things better. You don't even have to offer anything. And right off the bat, you'll see so many customers just genuinely want to be heard. like people that spend their hard-earned money on your whatever BS you're selling, they really want to be heard on what went well, what didn't go well. And I think you'd be shocked that you don't have to offer a $300 gift card. You don't have to like dance around and create focus groups that are super like lunch in an office with like a big buffet. Like you don't have to do any of that. Like people just want to talk and want to hear what you're up to. So I'd say like that's number one, is just jump in and do it. Like worst case scenario, you're back to where you started. Best case scenario, you learn 50 new things. I'll give you an example. For us at Jones, you know, Jones is Bobby Brown, and Bobby Brown has done this before, and she knows, I mean, she's a visionary. She knows exactly what needs to be built, what products don't exist, how to build them. The one thing we didn't realize is how broad our customer base is. We were so sure that these were all like Bobby fans, and they were all like the people that have been following Bobby since 1990s. These are people in their 50s, 60s, 70s. And we spoke to 30, I spoke to like 30 plus customers, and I learned that some of them are the daughters of the big Bobby fans and are much younger. Some of them are like doctors and lawyers that are in their 30s, but have super busy days and just want something easy. Some of them are moms that just want something clean. Some of them are like race car driver. Like we spoke to a race car driver, and she just loved the fact that it felt so effortless. And that was not somebody, that was not an avatar we were looking at previously. So I think like we, and based on that, so now that we understand our customers are not just women in their 60s, we suddenly start creating images and ads with younger models, with people that look different. And it changes the copy on your page. Like I recently heard a quote from the current CEO at Jones Road, Cody, saying like, we've done more, we've like had a larger impact from changing the header on the homepage than like all the A/B tests we've done in every part of the journey in the last 6 months. And that's just like such a great example of, it's the little things that feel little that like, who cares, but you're just now talking to a different person in the tone of voice they want to hear about a USP they didn't know existed. It's just like these little things that people spend so much time sleeping on. And then you do it and you're like, wait, that's a six-figure uptick on changing a header.
Yeah. And that's such an easy, small thing. One, it's easy to test, right? You could do a quick and easy split ABC, however you want to do it. You can do some in like pre-launch testing, right? That's an easy thing to test that can make a big difference. It's also weirdly something that if you kind of mess it up, it actually can have a big impact. Because you mentioned like if you went a new header and it went in the wrong direction, it can actually hurt you. And those small little details. And yet we obsess over this invisible process that never actually gets executed because it's too complex, too overwhelming, too difficult. And we obsess over it because we think that that's where the underlying operational efficiency and growth lies. But in reality, it could be small, tiny tweaks that you just do because it feels right or because you talk to your customer. How many brands do you think actually do like a postmortem? Like, hey, you didn't come back. Because I can tell you, I've canceled a lot of software in my day, and I've never once had, I get the like, as you're trying to cancel, like, no, don't go. Can you stay for another 6 months? Like those kinds of things. But I don't know that I've ever had someone say like, hey, I saw that you canceled this like 4 or 5 weeks ago. Can you just tell me why?
I have worked with well over 100 brands in the last 4 years. I think there's probably two that I've spoken to that actually do this.
That is wild.
Yes. In 2%. A meaningful way. In a meaningful way, meaning like, yes, you can run like a stupid little survey that's automated 10 minutes after the thing, like tell us why. But in a meaningful, like send the message, ask the question, one-to-one, wait for the response, book a call, get on the phone. Like I can think of two. And that's like, and it's pretty sad because it feels like a large lift. It's really, really not. Like some of the dumbest things are actually like, even on the SaaS side, like even on the Uphill side, like we've tested the silliest little headers. Like we've gone super sophisticated on how we pitch SMS. And then you just test like make more money with SMS. And that'll blow everything out of the water on like the most sophisticated, thoughtful, you know, super, super sharp headers. And I think that's like my biggest learning from all of this is like we overcomplicate stuff for no reason. Like we overcomplicate everything for no reason. Like simplicity is almost always harder. Funny enough, it's like harder to do things simple because your brain just doesn't allow, like it feels too dumb. Like it feels too dumb that like make more money with SMS will be the killer.
Right. Well, and I think part of that too is our like main character culture, right? If I'm just saying make more money with SMS, then people might not think I'm smart enough to be more sophisticated. I'm not clever and I'm not creative and I'm not, you know, a game changer and I'm not driving innovation forward, right? All of these things that we put in our LinkedIn bios or in our in our resumes of like drove innovative transformation synergy buzzwords. And those things really don't actually move the needle, because odds are good that if I just picked up the phone and said, hey, do you want to make more money with SMS? You'd probably say, everybody wants to make more money. I guess SMS might be the way to do it. But yeah, it's not sexy. It's not fun. Yeah.
I think it's even more so with the, like the chat GPTification. Yeah. Sorry. Something like
the,
that of the world.
Generative AIification or whatever
exactly.
we're going to call it.
Exactly. We've gotten to a point where like anytime you see anything like that, you know, it's just AI slop anyway. So you're like, okay, at least this feels human. When somebody says like, I was able to impact massive change at Yotpo, when they write that on their resume or in their LinkedIn, at least that feels like a human wrote it versus whatever slop people are writing today with a bunch of M dashes and chaos.
Okay, so don't my M dash. I was using M dashes in 2015 before.
Same.
It was cool.
Same, but I stopped now because now it gets me in trouble.
I know it gets me in trouble. I actually, one of the things I started doing for all of my copy is I record a video of myself saying it out loud. And if I wouldn't send it to my friends without them being like flaming me for being pretentious, then I don't post it. Like if I wouldn't read this out loud to my friends and worry about getting made fun of, I'm not going to post it, because I just, like, even though we're behind screens, even though you and I are doing this call virtually, like we're still human beings who are trying to build something great or do something great or live our lives great. And yet we kind of get pretentious. I think that's the only word for it. We kind of get pretentious about it and have to create this visual illusion that we are smarter, better, faster, stronger, sexier, funnier than we actually are.
I'm actually excited for the kind of full circle moment when GPT slash AI is everywhere and people just come back to their kind of simple roots. Yeah. I think even more so on the business side, like the something that we've seen over the last 6 months is everyone saying like SaaS is dead. Like in the next 2 weeks, you will be able to create your own. And I'm like, okay, so
no,
do it.
Won't.
So do it,
so
Mark.
Do it. Yeah.
Please, Mark, make my day. Do a free Yotpo competitor tomorrow. And I think it's like, it's
without any bugs, with perfect onboarding, with thoughtful, like, come on.
And CS help, obviously, right?
Yeah.
If something breaks.
Exactly. Of course. No, that's not really how the world works, you guys. Yeah. Sorry. That's the hot take, you guys. Maybe that's not how the world works.
It's going to be like, I do think it'll be like an interesting 12 months, but I do think it's kind of like moving at a speed that nobody ever saw. But I think the kind of constant alarmist energy versus the idea that things will just get better. And yes, we'll probably see like I'm not one to pontificate on this because I don't know, but we'll probably see like an interesting 12 months. But I do think if SaaS doesn't get dramatically better, if content creation doesn't get better, if production of products based on research, like now you can research every product that's been created in the last 20 years, have GPT run it through all the medical studies and kind of say like, of all of these products, can you create a super product that has like all the things that AG1 has, as well as like all the things that Rich will put in their vitamins, and can you create like a super vitamin that removes all the BS that these people have? And I think like we're heading to a better place, but for some reason the alarmists are enjoying it a lot. So
I think unrealistic expectations about what the future looks like. It takes time to evolve these things, and it's not going to evolve to the level that we think it will.
I just hope. I hope that when we all lose our jobs, I hope that we get to like a cozy vacation for a year or two. Like, give us a sabbatical,
you know,
while
what?
The AI gods take over.
Take my job. I'll sit on the beach. It sounds good to me. Awesome. Eli, let's put someone else on the hot seat. So you were originally a hot seat recommendation from Christina Garnett, and she talks so highly of you. And so that's how you and I got connected and got on the show. Tell us, who is leading the charge? Who is changing the way we build relationships with our customers?
First of all, want to thank Christina, because she's been a huge inspiration for me throughout the years. Like I have been a recent come up. Like I've been working for 10 plus years on this, but no one knew who I was until a couple of years ago. And she's been just an icon. So a huge shout out to Christina. I think like one of the sleepers in the space to me is Matt Mullinax, CEO and co-founder of Huron, which is like a men's skincare company. I think a few things inspired me about him. He's one of the first people I met in this space. I we became super close friends, wrote a tiny check in the company a few years ago. But I think, like, I've seen, you know, in the recent Dr. Squatch announcement for whatever, $2 billion ballpark that it was sold, you've seen like probably 15 brands in that space that have kind of come up and died, because it's really hard to build a men's skincare slash personal care brand. It's really hard. Like, you're kind of going with the wave of people. Men carry more about their body than just like a Dove all-in-one product.
Some Irish Spring and and some Old Spice and call it a day.
Exactly. So it's like it's an interesting trend, but the resilience and the give a shit of that person is super inspiring. The level, he's one of the two people that I was mentioning that will pick up the phone and talk to his customers. He's like thoughtful, methodical, slow, steady, wins the race energy that I think is very rare in founders today. Like, people just love a good bump. They love a good kind of like consistent climb, and seeing like consistency in a real way of just like over time, just getting really methodical about product evolution and product launch and retention and build like slow and steady and aim for profitability. Like, I've seen a lot of brands. There's not many brands that have been built in a way like as methodical and thoughtful as he does. And I think he's just like got a really, really, really seriously wide scope of things that he can be dangerous in, which I think is like personifies like the 2025 founder is, can you be dangerous on the growth side? Can you mess around on CX and retention? Can you deeply understand what a marketing launch should look like? Can you understand influencer? Can you get knee deep on product? There's very few people that are dangerous across the board like that. So that's my hot seat.
I love that. And if someone is really connecting with you, they want to learn more, they want to follow what you're working on, where can they find you online?
So something about me, I built this whole online thing because I hate meeting people. I'm an introvert. I hate leaving my house. These are the confines I stay in. I'm out very, very infrequently. I write a newsletter weekly about customer experience and retention. That's like my heart and soul. It's Eli Weiss with an extra S. So eliweiss.com. That's been like 3 years going. Might die, might stick around. I don't know. And then the same Eli Weiss with an extra S on Twitter or X, and Eli Weiss, first name, last name on LinkedIn. But I'm always an easy person to message. We'll try my best to reply if I can muster it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for appearing on the Growth Signal. This was a really fascinating conversation.
Thanks for having me.